Welcome to the Empire Podcast, episode 274, A New Hope. It is a period of civil war. Chris Hewitt, demonstrating a shocking lack of work ethics, has taken an overdue holiday to France, leaving the Empire Podcast ripe for hostile takeover from me, James Dyer, the Emperor Palpatine, to his giggling salacious crumb. Yes, that's right, I'm back in the cockpit this week and nothing will ever be the same again. Coming up over the next 60-plus minutes, we'll be reminiscing about the raging 80s with Atomic Blonde star James McAvoy, breaking bread with Breaking Bad star Bryan Cranston, and sifting through the fetid sludge of fake news to pan out the odd nugget of movie-related gold. Joining me on this fool's errand, and conscripted largely against their will, are a pair of men who are less talented than the Coen brothers, less nostalgic than the Duffer brothers, and less French than the Dardenne brothers. They are the Brothers de Semlin. It seems only right to introduce them in the same order that their mother did. So first up is a man who knows more about the European theatre of war than Christopher Nolan, Harry Styles and Heinrich Himmler combined. It is the Lord of the Luftwaffe, the Wizard of the Wehrmacht, Phil de Semlin.
Seems only right to point out the Dardenne brothers are Belgian.
Belgian, yes. I was actually aware of that fact, but decided to take a little dramatic
not
license.
To be that twat, but yes.
I didn't know.
I was wondering if your intro was going to be shambolic.
And I didn't disappoint. What's going down in Philtown?
What's going down in Philtown?
What have you seen this week? You've seen nothing good.
At the movies?
Yes.
I saw, oh my God, I'm just going to just find a space in my pigeonhole. I saw the new François Ozon movie last night.
Of course you did.
I did. Which was quite racy.
Was it?
Quite sexy.
Bit sexy. Sexy,
yeah,
times.
It was a room full of sort of past their prime film journalists, should we say, myself included.
It's
quite steamy for really? A Wednesday evening, yeah.
Wow.
Double Jeremy Renier.
This sounds like something I will absolutely never see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good.
What if I say double Jeremy Renner?
Oh, that's fine. Okay. That's much better.
Yeah.
Well, okay, good. Thank you, Phil.
Pleasure.
The yin to Phil Jiang. The alpha to his omega, and the man who recently binge-watched the whole of Baywatch Nights for no reason I can really understand. It's Nick.
Hello. Nick. Hi, James.
It wasn't for
no reason, and I didn't watch all of it. I was hoping to get a Baywatch Nights feature into the magazine to tie in with the release of the wretched new Baywatch film. Sadly, it wasn't to be. But one day I will make it happen. But yes, I'm still trying to get rid of the memory of the episode in which David Hasselhoff battles a deformed Viking warrior who is set loose in LA in the present day. That's an actual episode of Baywatch Nights.
It's almost hard to believe this didn't become a phenomenon. What other terrible TV shows have you binged recently? You are famous for this.
Well, I did watch Game of Thrones, not terrible. having had it thoroughly spoiled by you.
Yeah. I do what I can.
I finally got around to that last night. What else have I seen? I watched LA Story this week. But that was because I interviewed the director, Mick Jackson, last night.
Very exciting.
Comedy director Mick Jackson of Fred's. But that was awesome. He's a very nice guy. But yeah, that's about all I've seen.
I'm still recovering from my binge watch of the Prison Break Return, which is terrible on so many levels. I can't even explain.
Not least that he died.
Yeah, that's true.
Series.
He did die at the end of, I want to say season 4, whenever the last one was. Mm. And then he's triumphantly back, but living in Yemen.
Was he in the Black Lodge? Was that what happened?
It's not dissimilar to Twin Peaks, except with more ISIS. It is. It's Michael Schofield versus ISIS. That's what this series was.
So it's sort of become Homeland.
I mean, it's unspeakably awful. It is. And Cliff from The West Wing is in it. So that's, you know, that's nice.
That's good. Talking of Game of Thrones, there were a couple of gentlemen sitting next to me at the screening last night, and they were talking about, I hadn't seen the episode at that
point. In English or?
No, they weren't talking in French. They were talking in English about the new Game of Thrones. Mm. Is there... And they were going to go into plot details. Is there an etiquette for telling off complete strangers for spoiling stuff?
Yes, the etiquette is don't be a twat. Never discuss Game of Thrones.
That's what I usually say to James, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm exempt from this. No, I have a whole thing. Like, if you're not going to watch Game of Thrones like live, then you're watching it on Monday night, which means you have to stay off the whole of social media for all of Monday because America likes to ruin Game of Thrones and indeed television as a whole.
What about this HBO hack? Are they going to spoil the whole show from now on?
Even if they leaked episodes on the internet, who'd want to watch it? Like, I would be like, I don't want to watch it on some dodgy, pirated... No, I want to watch it properly in 4K.
Okay. On the back of a dragon.
On the back of a dragon, yes. While being chased by White Walkers. That's how I like to watch my Game of Thrones.
Is there some way that Game of Thrones might have upset the Koreans? I'm just trying to figure out...
It could be.
If this is
it could be like The Interview again.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. We should start, really, shouldn't we? Should we start?
Oh, let's start. What? We started?
That's not really recording. This is the foreplay, Phil. Oh, we need to get on to the main event.
Okay.
Should we have a question? Should we start with a question? That is as we like to begin. This week's question, we had a number of them. Many of them, wags that they are, volunteered questions along the lines of, when is it interesting when a role is recast with someone shit taking on the role instead of the regular actor? And I have ignored all of those. Instead, we're going to go with Stuart Harbison, at Stu Harb, who says, I rewatched They Live last night and wondered what is the best film where sunglasses were an actual character. Now, I don't understand that question, and I sure as fuck don't have an answer for it. So let's dial it back to the best sequences with sunglasses. If for no other reason, then I get to talk about Iceman from Top Gun, who rocks those mirrored aviators like I think no man before or since.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I applaud the questioner for watching They Live, a film which everyone should watch. I don't know, I can't get a sense of how many people have seen it these days. Probably quite an underwatched film, the John Carpenter sci-fi film. It's amazing.
It's got Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Roddy Piper. And just to set up the story for that, basically Rowdy Roddy Piper, not playing himself, can't remember his character name, but he finds a pair of magical sunglasses. He puts them on and he looks around and he realizes that many of the people walking around LA are aliens. And they have been here for a while, and he looks at adverts, and the adverts transform into signs ordering, you know, them to consume and obey and all this kind of stuff. It's a really good sci-fi film, and it has an incredible fight scene involving two men brawling for about 25 minutes over a pair of sunglasses.
Yeah.
It's hard to top that as a sort of sunglasses moment, I think.
Did you know that Rowdy Ronda Rousey asked Rowdy Roddy Piper if she could be rowdy? She wanted his blessing to use his rowdy moniker, and he gave her a rowdy thumbs up.
If you're going to get rowdy, ask permission.
Yeah.
Did you know that he used to sell sunglasses when he was doing autographs at conventions?
Really?
You could buy a pair for $5.
Off Rowdy Roddy Piper. Wow, that's hilarious.
Good knowledge.
Rowdy Sunnies.
I'm going to throw out Terminator 2. Two sequences in Terminator 2. The bad to the bone bit where he leathers up as a biker and he nicks the sunglasses from the bar in his pocket. And also when the orderly punches him in the face and breaks his glasses and he gives her that stink eye.
That's a good one.
Before, like, face-palming her across the corridor.
Yeah, the first of those slightly ruined by Terminator 3, in which...
Oh, yes,
that dreadful
novelty
callback.
Sunglasses!
Does that upset you? It upsets me.
Jonathan Mostow has a lot to answer for. What a twat. I mean...
They're kind of red, sort of star-shaped.
It's so upsetting. It's so upsetting.
They're not good.
No.
They're not good.
They're not.
I'm going to just throw in another obvious one, The Blues Brothers.
Yes.
A film in which the two protagonists... Sorry for using the word protagonist, got very highbrow something. They're Ray-Ban Wayfarers, which I interviewed John Landis not too long ago. He said that that type of Ray-Ban was dying out and people weren't buying them anymore and they were close to being phased out entirely. They used them in Blues Brothers. The studio were furious. They didn't want the two stars wearing sunglasses for the whole movie, apart from the one shot where Belushi takes them off. And they became like a phenomenon. And then they started getting used in Risky Business, and all throughout the 80s, these sunglasses popped up everywhere.
Yeah, I think that the Risky Business launched the... I understand that it was some kind of product placement deal with Ray-Ban got involved in. They paid like $50,000.
Yeah, they became like the official Hollywood sunglass provider. They would turn up in Breakfast Club and all types of movies, this one pair.
Is this what put Ray-Ban on the map? I mean, were they high-end beforehand, or were they like the Matalan of accessories?
They were pretty big. They were pretty big anyway. But I think it was in the 80s.
Our knowledge of Ray-Ban's market share.
Jack Reacher would know the history of Ray-Ban.
I will say this, though, that after I saw Top Gun, I did get a pair of aviators.
Did you?
Yeah.
Were they mirrored?
But at 12 years old, I looked like a colossal twat.
Were they mirrored?
They weren't mirrored, okay. I don't think, no.
This is a whole thing. This is an interesting thing, because I also have bought a pair of sunglasses.
I've seen you wearing aviators when pretending to be Tom Cruise.
Yes, I went to a fancy dress party as Tom Cruise.
You went to, it was your fancy dress party.
Jump on the sofa, yes, all right. It was. I threw a party just for that.
That's the one when I went as Hitman.
You did, you had a barcode
terrified
on the back
you.
Of your head.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
It was a good look.
And Chris went as the character he played in Hostel
Part
2.
I mean, honestly, yes. Chris went as himself. As himself in Hostel Part 2. What a bell end.
But no, it's the Hangover Part 2 is not a great film. But I did think that the sunglasses that Bradley Cooper wore were pretty cool, so I came out of the cinema and Googled.
Did you really?
And I ended up buying that pair, and I lost them. But
of course you did.
For a brief period, I'd like to think that I look like Bradley Cooper in that.
Were you not tempted to get a pair of those pince-nez sunglasses that Morpheus has in The Matrix? You know, the ones without arms that just sit on the bridge of his nose?
No.
No?
No.
They're a little bit like tanning booth eye covers.
Yeah. They do. They do exactly what they do.
That's good. That's got one of the best reflections in a pair of sunglasses moment in a film.
Yes.
Where you see the blue pill in one eye and the red pill in another.
Yes, that's a great one.
Which I don't know how they did that shot, but that's a great shot.
Sorry to interrupt. That is a good shot. If they're talking about specific moments with sunglasses, just elaborating on what Nick was saying about the Blues Brothers, when they're in the tunnel with Carrie Fisher and he takes his shades off and gives her like the doughiest kind of John Belushi eyebrows. Yeah. It's just genius. Absolutely hilarious. And then just shoves her out of the way. And
I'd add to that the little green bag walk in Reservoir Dogs because they're all wearing sunglasses. I mean, sunglasses aren't what I'd call the key to that scene, but it's nice.
I mean, they make characters look cooler.
Yeah, they do. That's why we wear them. No one's actually in any danger of being blinded by the sun. We just wear them to look cool.
I can't remember which of the Matrix sequels, but it's the one with the fight in the rain. I'm sure many people are screaming.
The last one against the multiple.
Yeah, where he's
Smiths.
Fighting in the rain and he's wearing sunglasses for no reason.
Yeah,
well, it's not even sunny.
No.
Come on, come on, Neo. What are you doing? but yeah, they often, like, film posters often have characters wearing sunglasses just because they look cool.
Yeah,
Hot Fuzz. Cobra.
Yes,
Cobra is the one I think of straight away. Because, I mean, he's got that amazing gun that's basically a flame. It's like sort of...
Mm. Yeah.
It's like an alien blowtorch.
Yeah, with the laser sight. And he's always chewing a matchstick.
Mm. In my mind, he's got a bandana on. It's just... He is trying his absolute hardest to look cool in that shot. No one has ever tried harder to look cool.
He's a man who does not own pajamas.
I love Cobra. And the thing I always remember about that film is that Cobra's house has a massive Pepsi sign stuck on the side.
Does it?
And yeah, because it's got loads of Pepsi product placement in. So the opening of the movie is the shootout in the convenience
store. That's right,
And they keep having close-ups to cans of Pepsi. And then his house literally has a massive Pepsi neon billboard. It's amazing. Shameless.
That is shameless.
Ripe for a reboot.
Clever sunglasses. Do you remember in True Lies where he has the packet of cigarettes with a camera in it and he can see it in the sunglasses?
Yes.
And he's a bit worried he's at urinal, but he can see the terrorist coming behind him via the cigarettes, via the sunglasses. Also, Mission Impossible 2, where he gets his briefing through the sunglasses and then hurls them and they explode in midair.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That's a nice moment.
Comedy moment I'm going to throw in. Airplane. It's the double sunny reveal. Robert Stack takes off his sunglasses to reveal a second pair of sunglasses.
Amazing.
Which shouldn't work. It doesn't sound that funny, but I rewatched it on YouTube just before this, and it's amazing.
Did you ever... Now, there's a very real chance I'm inventing this, but I seem to recall in the 80s there was a film called Teen Agent starring Richard Grieco.
Yes.
21 Jump Street, and he had X-ray special agent sunglasses, and he used them to look at girls naked.
That's not how X-ray works.
No, it's not.
Or spycraft.
Or sunglasses.
Or being a teenager. Maybe it is how being a teenager works, but yeah, I used to love that film.
Yeah.
I used to love that film. I can remember almost nothing about it. But I used to really like it.
I know, Grieco was cool because he did, he wasn't cool at all. He was in Jump Street and he did that Jump Street spin-off called Booker, which is about his character Booker in 21 Jump Street. And then he did a straight-to-video erotic thriller about cats where people were kind of human-cat hybrids and it was all of its sexy times. And I think that was pretty much the end of his career.
Wow.
It's possible we've meandered quite far from the point at this point.
So
question answered?
Cool. I just want to throw in one final, the coolest sunglasses moment in cinema.
Yep.
John Woo's A Better Tomorrow.
Ooh.
Chow Yun-fat, he uses a cigarette. He uses a $100 bill to light his cigarette. And he's wearing sunglasses and it's all like lit up with the flames and the lens. It just doesn't get cooler than that. And he's indoors.
And he's indoors. So has no reason to wear them.
Yeah. You've got to kind of mention Audrey Hepburn, don't you, in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Lighting her cigarella with a $100 bill.
With a Cobra-style sidearm.
Prostitution is a disease.
Exactly.
She's the cure. That doesn't work at all.
No. Marcello Mastroianni in 8.5, for instance. Pretty cool.
But Lolita.
Yep. Good point. Lolita as well. But Walter and the dude... in The Big Lebowski.
Both where, yeah.
Whilst we're
Walter's norm specs.
Whilst we're doing, yeah, exactly, is like belligerently yellow Ray-Bans.
They really
whilst
are.
Whilst we're like promoting sunglasses brands. I think the dudes are Varney,
I believe.
Yeah, but there's a scene where they're in the, they go to get the ashes and they go sit down with the sort of stuffy Undertaker dude. And Walter's not wearing his sunglasses when the guy comes and sits down, but he sort of puts them on for the meeting and then just gets furiously angry, which is, yeah, very fun. Indoor sunglasses wear.
We should all be wearing sunglasses now. I'm quite disappointed that we're not. But that's it. That's our question. If you, a friend or a loved one, have a movie-related quandary you'd like us to address, then by all means do let us know. As ever, you can tweet us using the hashtag EmpirePodcast or email us at podcast@empiremagazine.com, and we're also on the Facebook. Right, we have not one, but two. Oh, Phil's put on sunglasses. Good man.
Tell me, is James an alien?
Yeah, hell yeah.
Oh, God, I knew it.
You have no idea.
These are the Greco sunglasses.
You're staring at me naked. That's just weird.
Nobody needs skeleton, that. James.
We have not one, but two interviews this week, so we better get on with one of them. First up this week is James McAvoy, a man who I can personally attest has the original Star Trek theme tune as his mobile phone ringtone. Chris spoke to our man McAvoy about David Leitch's redonkulously well choreographed action film Atomic Blonde, and here it is.
Delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by James McAvoy.
Hello, hello.
How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. This is your second appearance on the Emperor Podcast this year, which got me to thinking. Are you a podcast guy? Do you listen to podcasts?
The only podcast I think I've ever listened to
is the Empire Podcast.
The Empire Podcast.
Obviously.
But the only other one I've ever listened to is Serial.
You ever heard of that?
And that was pretty good. With Sarah Koenig.
Yes, yes. The murder mystery one, the unraveling, yes.
The unraveling of Adnan, I can't remember his second name, whether he did it or didn't, that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But other than that, no, not a podcast,
okay.
Dude.
Interesting, okay. So if you did a podcast, say you had some spare time, because I know you probably don't have spare time, but if you did, what would it be on?
It would probably be on actors, not films or anything like that, it would be on acting.
All right, okay.
Because I love talking about acting.
Well, like a deep dive.
Yeah.
With fellow actors.
Deep penetration. Full penetrative conversational podcasting.
Well, that's a completely different podcast. But yeah. That would be interesting because technique and process.
Technique, all process, sort of stuff. Speculation, maybe interviews with actors, talking about how they do what they do, because I don't know, people might not find it fascinating, but I find it really interesting talking about how other people do it compared to me or the other people that I've talked to.
There are things I always find fascinating about acting as well. I always want to know whether you now, do you think you're a better actor now than you were when you started out?
Yes.
Okay. In what way have you improved? And what made you improve?
I think my range is much bigger. I think I'm more aware of the story that I have to tell to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And not just, I think when I started out, I was just trying to be truthful. I was trying to be, whatever that means, I was trying to be authentic and truthful and believable. That was my prime objective. And that was kind of my only objective. And I felt like I was just sort of scrabbling to stay afloat to do that. And if I felt for a second like I was doing that, then it was a good day. Whereas now, I just trust all that's going to happen and I can concentrate on actually telling a story, being in charge of any version of the truth that I decide to portray, but I decide which type of truth I'm going to portray in order to tell the story and tell it in a particular way at a particular moment. And it means the story leads me and guides me more than some adherence to the idea that the truth is everything or that being authentic is everything, being believable is the most important thing. And for some actors it's all that matters, and for me I'd rather watch a dishonest moment that told me an interesting story than a guy being the most believable guy in the world but there's no great story being told. What I mean?
What about Atomic Blonde, which is I think David Leitch from this and John Wick seems to be a very fastidious director. He comes in with a very, very clear idea of what the frame's going to be and where you are within that frame. Is that fair? Or does he allow that sort of improvisation and collaboration?
Oh yeah, there was a lot of improv. I don't know about the rest of the actors, but I did a lot of improv, and he seemed to like me doing that and push me to do that. But he's got very strong ideas. He's got a very strong notion of what he wants the scene to be like. And if it's working, we all do it, and it's great. And if it's not working, yeah, we explore and we fool around a little bit. And if he's got time, he likes to sort of let it happen organically as well. I didn't find him prescriptive. I found him very collaborative, but still very much the leader of the ship, and a guy that likes being on a film set making movies, which not a lot of film directors that I've worked with do. They find it a trial, and they just want to get to the editing room and make their movie there and stop being with all these people who've made 200 more movies than they have, and they actually intimidate them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And David has been in the trenches for years, and he's sort of, you know, he's a grunt who's now got up to officer class.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it tells, because he loves physical production and everybody loves working with him because of that. His craft is honed. He's not picking it up because this is only his fourth movie. Do you know what I mean? I don't know how many movies he's made, but he's been second unit stunt director on gazillions. Yeah. So his craft is there. It's honed. He's a master craftsman, which again is pretty rare, because, you know, a prolific director doesn't get to make that many movies in their career. It just, you can't. It takes so long to make them, you know. Whereas he's been able to like jump from job to job to job to job to job. 3 months in this one, 2 months in that one, three months in this one, 2 months in that one. Another director might take him 10 years to make that many movies. So it's a joy working with him, because he knows how to get it done, and he knows how to get it done well. Particularly, I mean, he has many strings to his bow, but the amount of action movies I watch with amazing action happening, and I know that actor and that stuntman are doing incredible stuff, and I just can't see it. And he knows how to show somebody rolling down a set of stairs.
Oh, Jesus,
and you watch every bone crack. You can see every single tendon stretched. You know what I mean? It's like you see every punch, you see every jaw broken, you see every exquisitely fucking executed roundhouse kick. You see it all. You see it all, and you marvel at the brutal beauty of it. Do you know what I mean? Because of it. And it's just, apart from the fact that it's super stylishly done as well, I just get to see it. It's a prime requisite as a viewer, that you're allowed to see everything that happens.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And as an action movie, it's pretty rare.
You know where everyone is in relation to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Did you shoot this in between Apocalypse and Split?
No, I shot it after Split.
After Split.
It was between Split and Submergence. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's why I'm bald for nearly everything I do now.
I know this is the first time I've seen you with hair for about 2 years.
Yeah, and I'm going to shave it off next week.
Yeah. So you're going back into the fray.
Back into X-Men, then straight into Glass.
Okay.
So, yeah, it will be baldy me for, I think, until probably the end of the year. But I quite like it. I enjoy it. It's nice. It's simple, and I like it. My only worry is, though, that like when it finally grows back next year, I'm like, oh, I'm losing it. I'd rather lose it like slowly and see it going, rather than shave my head, let it grow back, and it just doesn't grow back. Do you know what I mean?
Do you have a history of baldness in your family?
Nah, not really.
Then you'd be fine.
Yeah, I think so.
You'll be fine. Yeah, my dad and my grandfather performed cue balls both. And
really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I also think that thing of, though, where people say, like, oh, you shave your head, it grows back curly, or you shave your head and it grows back different, or your cowlick's in a different place. I'm like, it's not true. Mine's just grown back the exact same way.
Believe me, if that were true, I would try shaving it. If I just knew it was going to grow back twice as thick in the areas where it's slightly thin, just, you know, fucking shave it. I don't care. But so you are going into X-Men. That is something that's happening.
Yeah, about a week and a half, 2 weeks, we're going to go up and start rehearsals.
All right, Grant, that's Dark Phoenix.
What we call it, Supernova, I think.
Yeah, whatever it's called this week, it'll be called something else. But but that's because the last time we spoke was for Split, and I know X-Men was on the agenda for everybody at that point. And you said that you weren't going back for New Mutants, certainly.
No, at one point I definitely was in that script,
right?
And that's why. And Simon Kinberg said I was in it as well publicly, so that sort of fueled it. But no, I think I'm out of it now. Whether I rock up in it later on down the road, I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, I'd be happy to pop in, help them out when they're busy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do a shift. But,
just pop around.
You know,
you're bald, you might as well.
Just drop in when they're inundated. Do you know what I mean? Give them a hand at the tills. That'd be nice. No, but they've got a nice guy. They've got, I think they've got Anya from Split, and they've got got lovely Maisie Williams, who's gorgeous and just so sweet. So no, it'd be a nice bunch. I don't know if Storm's in it. I'm not quite sure. I don't really know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well,
I think they're filming in Toronto or Boston. I'm not sure.
One of the two.
Something like
just,
that. Anyway.
Just pin it down a bit.
They were meant to be filming in Montreal at the same time as us, which would have just been mayhem.
Okay.
To have two X-Men cast running a bit Montreal getting hammered.
That would be
it's bad enough we won, mate.
Precisely. Would it be paintball? Was it paintball guns you were filming with?
All of it, mate. It's been paintball, it's been BB, it's been Gat guns, it's been potato spud guns, it's been punching games, it's been thinking golf, it's been football, it's been go-karting. We did pugilistic go-karting, which was, mate, honestly, it was one of the most terrifying things I've ever done in my life. I rammed Nick Holt about 40 mile an hour head on. It's just crazy. Golf cart racing, we've had a lot of craziness.
And the insurance guys, they know about this, so they don't know about this.
This is all in between movies.
This is, yeah, not while we were filming.
We did most of this
all.
The day after we stopped shooting.
That's going to be interesting. Because this is, of course, the first time your contract expired, I think it was fairly public. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so...
Yeah, no, we were all quite clear about it. Like, we're out of contract, clear, we're done.
But then, just when you thought you were out, they pull you back in. What is it about this one that's brought you back in? Or what is it? Is it Charles, or is it Kinberg, or what is it?
The only thing that ever gets me, I think, is the character. Don't get me wrong, I think Danny Boyle, when he offered me a job, I was extremely excited just because it was Danny Boyle. But and if it was Ken Loach offering me something, I'd do it no matter what it was. Yeah. But it's usually the character that I'm attracted to, and I don't really care who's directing it. But it is definitely the character this time. There is a cool thing happening with him. But I'm also excited to get to work with Simon.
Mm-hmm.
I've always worked closely with Simon as a writer and a producer. He's always been there every day, and he's been massively collaborative and has helped bring us on with where we are with the characters and stuff as well. But now that he's directing, I'm very excited to work with him and see what he brings to it as a director, not just as a writer-producer, but as a director, writer-producer, the triple threat.
Well, yeah, it's going to be like David Leitch. He'll have been on so many sets over the years.
Yeah,
he'll
I know.
He's become a sponge.
I hope so. I'm thinking he will, but I know the crew are enjoying working with him as well. So that's exciting. And it's just a great bunch of people. We love each other. We're a great company of people. Even new additions that came in last year kind of slotted in seamlessly. So I'm excited to go back. Yeah. I didn't think we would. Thought it would be three movies and then out, but if it continues even further, which I think they're planning to, then great,
fantastic. And then I'm hugely, tremendously, genuinely, throbbingly excited about Glass.
Oh yeah, no, so am I. I know nothing though. I haven't even received a script yet. Knight's released it on Twitter. I'm on my second draft and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, slip me something, pal. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not talking about compliments, just. Or the tongue, just give me the script.
Yeah,
I'm excited to see how it all plays out and what is it? Am I like the bad guy? Am I not the bad guy?
Do you team up with the other bad guy?
Do I team up with Glass? Do I team up with David Dunn? Do I go to Dunn's Stores? Do I go to Dunn's the Bakers in Crouch End?
That's a niche reference. So there's another niche reference. My God, you're going deep now. Deep cuts.
I know. Deep cuts, cut glass. I'm excited to see, and I'm also excited to see how Anya plays in it as well. Is she going to be the MacGuffin almost or something? I just don't know what happens. There's a world of possibilities.
Well, there was 24 characters now in Kevin Wendell Crumb.
Yeah.
And we only got to see, what, 9 of them?
Eight or nine.
So, by my maths are correct, that's another 47 options for you to play in this one.
Yeah, there's a lot. And I know he wants me to show a lot more this time.
You showed enough last time.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, the only thing is, I don't want to make a gimmick of him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
Because he's an interesting character. He's got his own truth and his own integrity going on. But it is a condition that people actually suffer with. So I don't want to just make it exploitative. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I certainly don't want to just make him the bad guy.
No, of course. But hugely, hugely excited. and so you definitely don't know what's happening. He hasn't just slipped you the script and you're just...
No, I truly don't know. I would give you hints if I did, honestly. I don't know what is going on, and I'm very, very, very keen to see what goes on, because it's just such a different dynamic as well. Mm. Like, the first one was like three, you know, relatively unknown actors, young actresses, a former colleague of Knight's, Betty Buckley from, I think, The Happening, who's like a Broadway star, and me, and that was it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it was, who knows what's going to happen? But next time, we've got Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, Anya and me. It's like, that's a different prospect.
Even if just the four of you in a room just talking for 90 minutes, I'd be on board.
Mate, just us doing a podcast, talking about acting and Dunn Stores would be enough.
We brought it full circle. Well, the last thing I'm going to ask you is, all right, so you do have some downtime on X-Men and Glass, and you do decide to start this podcast.
All right, okay.
About acting. Who's the first person on the other side of the mic?
Oh, that's a good question. Sam Rockwell.
Sam Rockwell?
What? Yeah, just one of my favourite actors.
Would you get him to dance?
Yeah.
Wouldn't really work in a podcast, though. That's the thing, you got to adapt to the format.
I don't know, maybe we just put the microphone up to my heart and you can see it beating faster as he gyrates, and that would be the fun thing. Sam Rockwell, who else? Sam Rockwell, Ben Whishaw.
All right, good choice.
And the final member of the first episode of my podcast would maybe be Joaquin Phoenix.
That would be amazing.
Interesting bunch, I think.
That would be good, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It would also be the last episode of your podcast, I've got a feeling, but...
Why? I just think you'd kill each other?
Yeah, all four of you would just, you'd just burn up the hotel room wherever it was you would be doing it.
I think so.
It would be the definitive podcast. You wouldn't need anything else after that.
I think so. I'm not sure. Who else? Maybe Judi Dench, actually. I just want to keep going now. Kate Winslet. I'd have Kate Winslet on there for a second.
Kate Winslet. There you go. Okay, so that's episode two. Right, brilliant. Next time you're on the Empire podcast, which will be for, I presume, X-Men.
Uh-huh.
At least I've got one episode in the can.
One episode? What do you mean?
Do an episode and have...
All right, okay.
Yeah,
episode, yeah. All right, well, why don't that's I host your... one? Why don't I host one for host Empire? One.
There we go.
And you know, that can be instead of doing this.
You know, it's legally binding, right?
Yeah.
It's all good.
Sweet.
Brilliant. James, thanks.
All right, mate. Cool.
Thanks, Phil.
Benjamin, thank you.
That was James McAvoy. Big fan of that film. David Leitch is, of course, the co-director of John Wick 1, alongside Chad Stahelski, and he had to bow out of the sequel to do Atomic Blonde. Love the 80s vibe of that. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a better action sequence anywhere this year.
So originally called The Colder City, wasn't it?
That's the graphic novel. It's based on the graphic novel called The Colder City.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the film was called that for a while. Is it the staircase fight? I haven't seen the film yet.
The staircase fight is pretty fucking impressive.
Is that the action scene you're talking
there's
about?
There's loads. I mean, it's full of them. It's full of them. I mean, it's not dissimilar to John Wick in that regard. They do really broad master shots, one shot, all the way through, just incredibly well choreographed. I mean, Keanu's slightly different because he's actually quite an accomplished martial artist, so he just sort of hammers his way through John Wick. I mean, Charlize Theron's got some experience, but I don't think she's, you know, a ninja. I think she's been extremely well trained through these sequences, but it's really, really fucking good.
It's essentially Joan Wick.
I did use that gag when I came out. Yes.
Oh, God.
First base gag number one.
God.
But it's out next week, so I guess we'll get into it properly in next week's pod. So, yeah. But if you go to the cinema before next week's pod, which you might, maybe go and see that.
Mm.
It's an option. Right. On with the news.
How? It's not out.
Will it be out on Wednesday? It'll be out on Wednesday.
Is it out on Wednesday?
The next pod isn't out until Friday. Come on, Phil.
He didn't explain that.
Stop pod-splaining.
He didn't explain that. Good soundtrack? Has it got a good soundtrack?
Yes, because it's 80s-tastic. Yeah. Although, I believe there are a couple of anachronisms on there, because it's set at the fall of the Berlin Wall, and I'm sure at least one of the songs came out or was released after the fall of the wall.
Does it have Scorpions, Winds of Change?
I don't know. The names of songs escape me. My memory doesn't work that way.
Okay.
But it is very 80s-tastic, and I enjoyed it. So, yes, news. On with the news. News. The biggest news this week is the announcement that Jack Thorne has been called in to rewrite episode 9, which is
wait, what were you going to say? I'll be the judge.
Clint Howard is in the Han Solo movie.
Yeah.
Clint Howard's...
Well, we were going to mention that.
It's the big news.
Yeah, okay. Well, is he chewy?
No, he's not. Let's move on.
This is because Ron Howard essentially tweeted that Clint would be... No, we won't be disappointed. Clint will make an appearance.
Okay. Let's come back to that. That's yeah.
Okay. Okay, so Jack Thorne has been called in to rewrite episode 9, which is quite a shock, really. The film, as we all know, has been written by Colin Trevorrow and his co-writer, Derek Connolly. But it's now been handed to Thorne... Mm. Who is the man who co-wrote Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. He's done work on Skins. He also wrote short-lived but very excellent TV supernatural sort of horror show, The Fades, right, which I watched a few years ago and very much enjoyed. Mm. What do we think of this? Because this is, I mean, this is either, okay, fair, you know, they've just, you know, Colin's got to focus on directing, so he's coming to help out, or it's a, we didn't like your draft, we're getting this guy in to do it again.
Yeah, we just don't know at this point, do we?
No, we don't.
It's not necessarily a shock because I think most productions of this size get quite a lot of people drafted in to do a pass on it. That's the sense I get from, I know there's a lot of, I know Christopher McQuarrie, for one, does a lot of uncredited work on stuff.
Yeah.
The fact he's been announced maybe means it's more substantial. I don't know. We just don't know. But it doesn't shock me that they're getting another writer involved because I imagine that happens a lot. They just, you know, they're at the point where they're trying to get it put as good as possible.
Well, Michael Arndt started off doing The Force Awakens and essentially couldn't turn it around in time, so Kasdan and Abrams did it. Although Rian Johnson's the only one pretty much who did The Last Jedi. He's done that start to finish.
Yeah. You just don't know whether it's, you know, just freshening up the dialogue or more substantial.
Adding knob gags.
Adding knob gags.
Taking out dinosaurs, maybe bringing in dinosaurs, and that would be a problem.
Yeah, Colin, stop it!
He's an interesting...
No more Gallimimus.
He's an interesting choice for it, though, isn't he? Because he's very much of the sort of British television school. He's very well thought of in this country. I don't know what his profile is in Hollywood, but, you know, he did the This Is England TV spin-offs. Maybe he'll take this one grittier.
Maybe.
The tales of intergalactic alcoholism and drug abuse. Who knows?
I mean, I think it's one of these things where, you know, people are looking for, you know, after the Lord and Miller thing, people are looking for sort of trouble in paradise when it comes to Star Wars. So people, oh God, what's gone wrong? Trevorrow's fucking it up. And I don't think that's probably the case at all. I think it is, you know, it's more than likely something logistical.
These are the things that happen on just about every major film and just
you don't always hear
reported
about it.
Because they're not of that profile.
I guess if Ron Howard had suddenly come in, then maybe you'd start to be a bit more worried. Or Clint Howard, for that matter.
Clint Howard is now directing episode 9.
Ron Howard just starts taking over every Star Wars project, like at the last minute.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really like Jurassic World. I may be slightly biased because I pop up for an unmemorable 1 second cameo. But yeah, I feel like it's probably in a good place because they've been on it for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not very early in the stage. I think they've probably been, the script has been around for a while. So
yeah.
I imagine it's a pass.
An interesting wrinkle then, but not something that we should be concerned about. Unlike Clint Howard.
No one should be concerned about Clint Howard unless you've seen his film, The Ice Cream Man, which has traumatized me. This is his 1995 or 6 horror in which Clint Howard roams the land in an ice cream van eating people and mixing them up and
he
serving
screams,
them as ice cream.
You scream, we all scream.
For The Ice Cream Man.
Yeah.
It's upsetting. Wow. But other than that, I mean, I think this is like this is going to be the 18th film that Ron Howard has put his brother Clint in.
There's nepotism and then there's nepotism and this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Can you get me into Jurassic World 2?
I can't get myself into Jurassic World 2. No.
Okay. Disappointing.
But, you know, it's my favourite Clint Howard moment in the film.
I definitely don't have a favourite Clint Howard moment.
He's awesome in Austin Powers.
He is awesome in Austin Powers, yes.
Obviously, he's popped up in loads of Star Trek episodes, so... Surprise!
Yeah, but with various amounts of prosthetics glued to his face.
Well, anyway,
yes,
we love Clint Howard.
Love a bit of Clint. Also, the first image of Zazie Beetz as Domino was tweeted out.
Domino Harvey.
My name is Domino Harvey, and I'm a bounty hunter.
That's very Rich D. Grant.
Yeah, thanks. This is from Deadpool 2. Domino, for those of you who are not au fait with the character, first appeared in X-Force number 8 in March 1992. I have the first edition at home if anyone wants to buy it off me. As a member of the Wild Pack, later renamed the Six Pack, if you can stomach it. her power is luck. She has probability altering powers, and she kind of appears here in a kind of it's kind of a blaxploitation vibe, isn't it, that she's got. And you see her kind of in the same way we first saw Deadpool reclining in front of that fire. On a whatever it is, like a bearskin rug. It's her reclining in front of the fire on a Deadpool skin rug.
I kind of love that. I think the original was inspired by a Burt Reynolds Playgirl pullout.
It was.
But yeah, they're going meta with it. Like she's now on. I didn't know whether it was meant to be a Deadpool rug or whether it's actually him.
It's
that's
a flat
crushed.
A flattened Deadpool.
But that was Ryan Reynolds. That was a great reveal. I'm excited. Unlike you, I don't know the character as well, so I don't know quite where they're going with it. But yeah,
she's less stylized in this. But I think it's fun. It fits the Deadpool vibe quite well. I think it works with the aesthetic.
Does this imperil the future of a
Negasonic teenage warhead? Not necessarily. Well, she was only a supporting character anyway. She could still return. Okay. She was not a love interest, though. She's like 10 or something.
No.
Whereas actually, Domino is a former squeeze of Cable
in
the comics. So I don't know whether that's something they'll
You could say she was cable tied. That doesn't work.
You shouldn't, but you could. Yep. Yes. So that's a thing. So yeah, Domino. Yeah. And in other news, assuring the high production values and quality of the highly anticipated Transformers spin-off Bumblebee, John Cena, the Doctor of Thugonomics himself, will be headlining.
I don't care. What's next?
I mean, look, I want to just chip in a slightly weak defense of this film. I am not a fan of Transformers. Any right-minded person does not enjoy the current run of Transformers films. They're not very good.
When you say the current run, do you mean like all of them from the beginning?
I think we all quite enjoyed the first one.
I think most of us
enjoyed it, if only for the kind of novelty value, but also Shia LaBeouf was fun. And it has now degenerated into Mark Wahlberg running around yelling at bits of CG. But yeah, Travis Knight is directing this.
He is. Kubo's Travis Knight.
The Leica animation genius, I'd say. I mean, he's really great. Everything he's done has been interesting. And so he's the reason I'm giving this one a chance.
I mean, Hayley Steinfeld's in it as well. It's set in 1987, so it's actually a prequel. Presumably because after the last night, no one knows what the fuck is happening. And they've essentially had to reset the chronology. But the whole idea is, and forgive me if this sounds familiar, they're working on an old car. It turns out to be Bumblebee, and he comes. Isn't that just the first film? Because the Witwicky gets the car, doesn't he? And then it's a living car, and it's the same film again.
He's never been my favourite, even among. I mean, I don't like any of them, but the robots in these films. But he's the one who peed on John Turturro in the second one, right?
Who knows? He doesn't. He's the one who doesn't talk.
Yeah,
but he is the last. Oh no, I nearly spoiled the last night. Sorry.
He's the snippets of.
He's kind of the dog, isn't he? I suppose.
Yeah. He's the lovable hound of the Transformers.
I've not warmed to him yet, but look,
no.
I just in Travis Knight we trust. The casting of John Cena doesn't inspire massive confidence because it just feels like, oh, they've got another Mark Wahlberg type person. I don't know. I just thought the casting for this might be a bit different and a bit more interesting. I don't know.
I mock, but he was funny in Trainwreck.
He was good in Trainwreck. Mm. He was good in Trainwreck. I did. Okay, let's give it a chance because we don't know who he's playing or whatever. But as a leading man, I guess there are maybe other actors that I'd be more kind of excited
about. All of them. Right. Excellent.
It would be remiss of us not to mention that Darren Aronofsky's mother, or as the title is read with the exclamation mark, mother, is got a trailer.
Is it good?
So now we know kind of what it is because there was a bit of a.
Well, it hasn't cleared up much.
No, it hasn't really, but you at least have a sense of the genre.
Explain, I haven't seen it.
The film has an exclamation mark at the end of Mother, and if trailers could have an exclamation mark at the end, this one would, because it basically is madness.
Right.
It's Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem. It's very much a psychodrama.
Yeah.
As far as I know, they're kind of husband and wife, and somebody comes to the house, and they're not really giving much away. There's not a lot out there about this one, but it looks like it's... You know, it's pitched at quite a high frequency, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It looks very much like a kind of Black Swan-esque film, but maybe even more intense than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So interesting.
It's not cleared up much, but it has at least given, because up until that point, I don't think anyone had an idea. They thought maybe it was going to be a frothy rom-com, potentially, but not.
A knockabout sex comedy.
Yes.
Okay.
Another
trailer?
Another trailer, quickly. Mindhunter.
No, you mean Mindhunter, for the title is in all caps.
Yep, not to be confused with Mindhunters.
The Christian Slater.
The Christian Slater trapped on an island with a serial killer. It's another serial killer thing.
Yeah. Doesn't it have the exact same plot as Detox?
Very possibly. I haven't seen Detox.
Fair enough. Sylvester Stallone, I believe, it's trapped in rehab, and it's just the same. Anyway, carry on.
Trapped in rehab?
Yeah, he goes on a rehab retreat, possibly on an island, and one of them's killing them. It was a long time ago, and it's dreadful.
Yes, but Mindhunter, singular, is David Fincher, his new Netflix show, which is coming in October. And it's really about these FBI serial killer profilers who are kind of going out and teaching normal policemen how to think like a serial killer. And it's got two more or less unknown actors at the top of it, Jonathan Groff and Holt McCallany. And the trailer is kind of what you'd expect from maybe a David Fincher thing. It looks like kind of got a bit of a Zodiac vibe. It looks like a bit of a slow burner, but really stylish and interesting looking. I'm on board.
Okay, good. I haven't watched that either. But yeah. I'm sure it's great.
Yep.
I have seen the Hans Zimmer has jumped on board to provide additional music for Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, interesting one, that.
Because this is Johan Johansson's score, and yet it's been Zimmered. Yeah. I don't know quite what to make of this. Is it a scheduling thing? Because the film's 2 months out at this point.
No, I don't know. Slightly worried about this.
But
I feel like Vangelis. His score is so instrumental to the success of the mood of the original film. For them to be fiddling around with the music now, like they don't really know exactly what they're aiming for, just worries me slightly. And there is another kind of murmur that because the film hasn't been entered into Venice, the Venice Film Festival would be an obvious place with the timing for it to go, that maybe there's not so much confidence in it. Well, but, who knows at this point? It's still a way out. But yeah, the music, I always, from the beginning, I was like, how do you do it without that score? And you'd need to almost start the process with thinking of the music. Yeah. And they seem to be ending it that way.
The Blade Runner score is kind of a thing separate to the film. I probably listened to the score 100 times.
Yeah, more than you've seen the film.
And I've probably seen the film probably about 10 times, but still, the score is its own thing. It's you just listen to it independently.
Yeah, it's great.
It's amazing. And yeah, I do wonder whether there was ever talk of him doing it, coming back and doing it again. But yeah, it does make me worried, because that's so important. Yeah. It does look like they've got the visuals right from the trailer. I think it's got that Blade Runner feel, but the music kind of...
Especially, I mean, look, I love Hans Zimmer. I know the Dunkirk score kind of polarised people.
But Dunkirk score put me in mind of Johan Johansson.
Yeah.
Because it was like a wall of sound design, wasn't it?
Yeah. But this sort of thing he tends to get parachuted into a little bit. You know, and I got a vision of him turning up with like literally a toolkit going, right, what needs, you know...
It's like the A-team.
...doing with his guitar. And yeah, I don't know, there's something...
If you have a soundtrack, if no one else can help.
Yeah.
And if you can find him.
Zimmer. Call him. He's got Going for Gold. He can do that for you. he can do Blam.
I mean, it kind of makes sense, though, in a way. His Inception score, I think, has got...
Oh, my God, yeah.
I mean, probably definitely my favourite score from, like, the last 20 years, but it's got that emotion and that kind of weird, kind of ethereal otherworldliness that the Blade Runner score has. Mm. It's obviously a different type of soundtrack, but I don't know. That if it's Inception Hans Zimmer... Great.
No,
No,
I don't know. It seems to me like he'd have to be building on what.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying he doesn't break out the synths. I'm sure there's going to be going to be Synth City, but I don't know. He hasn't got long to get his synths in order. Up.
Get your synths in order.
Well, if anyone can do it, Zimmer can do it. In other news, Vin Diesel is resurrecting Miami Vice. Did you read this? No?
I read that, yeah.
I mean, yeah, he is and he isn't. He's exec producing a TV show which is going to pilot, which is a new and updated non-80s set, Miami Vice, Crockett and Tubbs, in the 21st century, presumably.
It's already better than the Michael Mann movie.
Are you a big hater?
I do not like that film in any way, shape, or form. No.
Why?
Because it's dreadful.
It's not good.
No, it's
it is
so good. Dreadful. It's not. It's not among his best, but it's a good film.
Go to Cuba for a mojito.
Yeah, we've all done it, Nick. My biggest problem with that is the sound mix in Miami Vice is fucking awful. Like, it's really muddy, and you can't make out massive sections of the dialogue.
My problem with it is everything else. So between us, we found the perfect storm of hatred for that movie.
It's very blue. I've only seen it one time, but I remember it being very blue and very just people.
I just have a vision of Colin Farrell with like one button on his shirt done up, like just chest and like blazer and just wrong. I mean, if they'd made it 5-6 years later, it would have been a Lord and Miller kind of Jump Street scenario. But he went instead for like just the heaviest level of bombast.
Yeah,
I'm just not a fan. I know there are people that defend and love that film, and that's fine, absolutely, you know. But I'm saying they're wrong.
I quite like the line, there's undercover, and then there's which way is up. And I've repeated that. That's a line that someone says in the film, and I have repeated that a lot because it's such a stupid, brilliant line.
Oh, it's a great line.
I mean, what next? Like Michael Mann's Hawaii 5-0.
See, you joke, because Hawaii 5-0, the rebooted TV series, ran for a while. I don't think it goes anymore. Equally, the Lethal Weapon TV series has been renewed for a second season. So it is quite possibly the end of days. This will join them. There's a, I think it's, I want to say it's going to Stars, which is the network that does... Well, some good stuff. I think it does American Gods, but I want to say also it's the same place where Stephen King's The Mist TV series,
interesting,
which is not good, is, though I could be making that up.
Yeah.
Speaking of TV, the Divergent TV series is definitely going ahead because this has been in sort of spinning development hell for a while. You will recall there was Divergent, then Allegiant, and then Ascendant did not ascend.
Is there one called Convergent? Or is
Convergent, but they were going to do potentially a spin-off, which presumably would have been called Tangent. They weren't sure if the TV series was going to be, will it be a TV movie of Ascendant? Will it be a TV extension of the story? Will it be a spin-off thing? None of us really care, and nobody really knows.
Is it the one that Kate Winslet was in?
Yes,
where they've got all right.
Yes, where they're all, everyone's sorted according to like personality traits.
Oh my word!
But then they change the form of the adjective, so it's
right, because you've got more that you can do. You've got more than one personality.
Yeah, so it's Dauntless and Erudite, and then I can't remember the other ones. But
I had a really, really, a train crash interview with Kate Winslet about that one.
What did you say?
Well, it wasn't okay. Train crash is exaggerating, but we had a short time together, fortunately for her. And I had to sort of concertina my questions, and I didn't really get to talking to her about the film.
Really?
Yeah. She called me a nutter. She was like, "You're not going to ask me about the film at all." And I went, "Well, I wasn't planning on it." And she went, "You're a nutter." And I was like, "Well, they gave me 3.5 seconds. Yeah, I didn't have time. Plus, I didn't add. It's not.
It's terrible.
It's going to end up on television." Because I knew back then, I could feel it. Not disrespecting your newspaper. I feel that story. I feel like we knew that, didn't we?
No, it's been. That's what I'm saying. It's been banging on for ages, but apparently they have confirmed it's going
it's
ahead.
Re-emergent.
Whereas it's come back. It's come back.
Right.
James, on behalf of everyone, thank you for bringing it.
Thank you for bringing that up again. Like,
this is great podcast.
It is great.
I don't mean to bring the mood down, but there are a couple of people who passed away in the last week, and it would be remiss of us not to mention first Jean Moreau, who is a stalwart of the French New Wave. She was in Jules et Jim. She did not play Jules or Jim. La Notte Antonioni, and this is so in my but she was genuinely a great of that period of cinema. And I would just say that if you haven't seen Louis Malle's Elevated to the Gallows or Lift to the Scaffold, it's one of those films with about 7 different names, check it out. It's an amazing movie. It's got Miles Davis recorded the score, I think, in like a night, in the way that those sort of jazz musicians could do. It's really very cool. It's got a great premise in which a crime has been committed, but the people that perpetrated, I think, have locked themselves out of the apartment they need to get back into. So it's a kind of a slow motion noir kind of thriller, but with a French New Wave twist. So check that out. That's would be a great way to remember her. Sam Shepard, last Thursday, died. Mm. And he's someone that kind of is very much in our world, obviously as an actor, but also in the world of theatre as a playwright. And he was a screenwriter as well. I especially love him in The Right Stuff, in which he played Chuck Yeager,
yes,
the pioneer of space travel, like a genuine American hero. And Sam Shepard kind of was too. They didn't get on that well, I think, when they first met. And Philip Kaufman, the director of that movie, wrote a really nice obituary for Variety remembering him. And he sort of described him as, like, he was also kind of like a jazz musician as well himself, but kind of like a genuine cowboy. He worked on a ranch as a teenager and he had a horse on The Right Stuff. More movie sets should have actors that have horses.
I agree entirely.
Apparently he would just, they would be discussing scenes and he would just be lassoing furniture, which could be the most effective thing ever. But I think in Sam Shepard's case, probably wasn't. So yeah, Days of Heaven, The Right Stuff, Paris, Texas, and more recently, Bloodline, the Netflix show.
Yes, I haven't seen
that.
He was
the sort of patriarch in that. And Mud, the Jeff Nichols movie, is very good.
Yes.
So he was doing great work right up until the end of his life. And, He died pretty young, really. He was born in 1943, so, you know, in his 70s. So a sad loss in both cases.
He won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing.
Did he?
One of the plays he wrote, Buried Child. But yeah, he was a real Renaissance man, I think. And he had a kind of very soulful presence, I think, in all the films he appeared in.
You've seen The Right Stuff, haven't you?
I've seen The Right Stuff.
It's such a good movie. If you haven't seen The Right Stuff, that would be... I would rectify that immediately.
One of the main,
not just him, but, you know, Scott Glenn and...
It's one of the main influences for Interstellar. Right,
yeah, it's a genuinely brilliant film and fully recommend that people watch that. And also, he was in Black Hawk Down, but everyone was in Black Hawk Down.
That's so true.
I was in Black Hawk Down.
Mm. Edmund's early appearance.
Yes.
Yeah, Private Edmund in that one. Yeah, he got killed at the beginning. Does anyone have any more news? Unless anyone wants to talk about Ian McShane in Hellboy?
There's one more snippet of news, which is that Jorge Gutierrez, who directed the Book of Life, which was a Guillermo del Toro animation.
I like
animation.
The Book of Life a lot.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I know it covers the same ground as Pixar's new film Coco,
yes, it
and
does.
Different films. And he is directing a new Lego movie called The Billion Brick Race. And how do we feel? Do we feel like there should be more Lego movies, or are there enough Lego movies?
The Lego movies leave me largely cold. I'm afraid
we need Emma Froer here to represent, because she's a huge Lego enthusiast. I always feel slightly guilty. I don't enjoy them more. I was really looking forward to Lego Batman, and I must say, I didn't.
No, neither
I didn't
did
love
I.
it, and I didn't love the Lego movie, but I realise we're probably in the minority.
Yeah, everyone else in the office seems to think, well, that everything is awesome. I'm personally not of that opinion. But they're fine. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just not the second coming. Like Helen will squee to the high heavens whenever you mention a Lego movie, and I'm just like, please, I'm a grown man.
I know that they're not. But
says the man with a collection of swords.
Shut up, Nick. And finally, we will mention that Ian McShane has joined Hellboy, The Rise of the Blood Queen. He's playing Professor Trevor Bloom, which was the John Hurt role in the Guillermo del Toro versions of Hellboy, which is Hellboy's kind of adoptive father.
That's interesting.
Obviously, David Harbour is Hellboy himself, directed by Neil Marshall. And Mike Mignola, who's the guy who created Hellboy, he's, I think, on scripting detail for this. So interesting.
Yeah.
It's the thing, because Guillermo it seems like less than a year ago that Guillermo finally said he was never going to be able to make Hellboy 3. It just wasn't going to happen. And then this has kind of emerged phoenix-like from the ashes. We shall see.
This is Neil Marshall directing.
Neil Marshall directing.
See, I'm excited about it. We were just talking about The Descent in the office earlier today.
Yes,
and
we were.
How great The Descent is. And his Game of Thrones episode is terrific. So I'm excited.
Like,
I'm actually really
he's
excited about seeing what Neil Marshall can do.
That conversation was let down slightly when someone said he hasn't done anything good since Chicago.
It was a genuine. I misspoke. I didn't think that Rob Marshall. Neil Marshall, director of Doomsday and Chicago.
I would like to see Rob Marshall's The Descent with the singing goblins.
So would I. Yeah, that would be great. But no, this came about because we were saying, and this nearly became this week's question on the podcast. I nearly hijacked it and made it this one, which was, what is the film that has most scared you since you've been working at Empire? Because that ruled out The Omen and Alien and all of the really scary stuff. And Nick pointed out The Descent. And obviously the point with that is, even if you took out the goblins, just the claustrophobia of it is absolutely bare-bollock terrifying. When she gets trapped beneath the... I mean, it's just, oh, Christ.
I was squirming.
Yeah,
same
here.
Watching that, yeah.
It's a hell of a good film. Yeah, and yeah, I don't know. Horror films don't scare me that much these days. It takes. I think you said that, Phil. It needs another layer. Like, you need claustrophobia and then horror.
Green
or you
room.
Need grief and then horror. You need two layers of emotional.
I say Green Room recently, actually.
I haven't seen it.
Didn't watch that on the big screen, but just even watching it on DVD or Blu-ray, really, that's an intense film. Mm. You should watch
it's like
that.
Untidiness. And then horror. In that case.
it's just disarray.
Someone mop this place, please, immediately. I can't. I'm not OCD, but I'm. You know, it makes me feel scratchy.
Okay.
Or they're Nazis, and then you could say.
Oh yeah, probably, Nazis and horror. Yes, that's
dirty Nazis
dirty.
And then horror.
Dirty, yes. Mm,
you're
yes.
Dirty Nazis.
Slob-like, slatternly Nazis.
Quite.
Right. Okay. It's time for another interview, I think. This is John Nugent hanging with Bryan Cranston to talk about his new film, Wakefield, which is not, in fact, a hard-hitting drama about street thugs in West Yorkshire, but rather the story of Howard Wakefield, a man who has a nervous breakdown and goes to live in an attic for several months, something we've all done at one time or another. Bryan Cranston, welcome to the Empire Podcasts. How
thank
are you?
Good to be here. I'm great, thank you.
Great. We're here to talk about Wakefield, which I guess you would you describe it as the latest entry in the Bryan Cranston midlife crisis genre?
Get on train. I suppose. I don't. Of course, look at it in that sense is too objective. What got to me about the script of Wakefield was that I related to this man as a man who is, you know, under a lot of pressure, as we all are. Our level of responsibility is high. We are expected to produce a lot more because of the technology that is available to us. Look, what would we do without our iPhones and our laptops? And I mean, we are governed by that. In fact, every waking moment we have, we're checking into to our lives, maybe to even the idea that I just want to get rid of a few of the emails, get them off our plate so we don't have a tremendous amount to deal with. We're just spinning plates. So Howard Wakefield is a man who's a Manhattan lawyer, very, very accomplished, has a wife and two daughters and a nice home. And yet he still feels like he's on the hamster wheel of life. He wants to slow down. He wants to push the pause button and just relax, read a book, have a glass of wine, look at a cloud, go for a walk, be more in control of his own time and destiny. So he does. He puts himself in the attic and there he stays. And he's only intending to stay a day, and it turns out to be 2 days. Okay, well, I'll re-enter at some point. And then it's 3 days, then it's a week, then it's more than a week, then the longer it takes for him to confront the issue that was originally before him, the larger the chasm it becomes to be able to cross it. And I get that. I see that we can exacerbate a problem simply by trying to avoid it.
Was it an interesting acting challenge for you? Because, as you say, you were in an attic, essentially acting against no one for the majority of the film. And there's a lot of inner monologue as well. So you obviously spent a lot of time in a recording booth. What sort of challenge
I did. Robin Zweikert, who wrote a beautiful script and directed the movie, wanted me to do the narration three different times. One before we started, one during the time we were shooting, and one well afterward. Right. And I thought it was curious and interesting to do that. Because, yes, naturally, it would seem right that your experience will change you over the course of how you see the character and how you're going to present any line in a narration. And so we did. And I'm not sure exactly which lines that made it into the movie were done before or during the middle or after.
Like many children of my generation, I went to bed wearing Power Rangers pajamas. So I'm always truly honored to be sitting opposite the man who played Snizzard and most recently Zordon.
You cynical bastard. I didn't even remember the name of that character or the other characters that I play. Snizzard.
Snizzard, yes. Yeah,
it sounds like a condition that someone may have, you know. It's got a case of the snizzards. When I was first starting out, there was a lot of voice work that I did, and one of the things of voice work was doing the dubbing from Japanese to English of the original television show, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Mm-hmm. And just last year, I was able to kind of come full circle and play Zordon, the face within the wall, who is kind of the mentor of the Power Rangers, and to be it in the big movie. And it was fun to do, very interesting, and a good story. I thought I was very happy with the outcome of the show, and it did well in theaters.
Yeah, I mean,
did you like it?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, it was a very formative show. So, is it strange to be sort of part of that experience growing up for like two generations of children now?
No, it's not strange for me. It's more strange for you to imagine that, because it was your formative years.
Yeah.
It wasn't for me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I could point to things and you'll go, I've never heard of that. And so, well, yeah. And that's what, again, getting back to some things we'll know and some things we won't.
Yeah.
We could get together a while from now and you'll go, I remember exactly where we were, what we met, what we talked about. And I go, I have no idea what you're talking about. And because it might have been important for one person and not the other.
Right.
And that's the glory and the curiosity of the human experience.
I mean, looking over your CV, you have... You're in so many, you know, classic TV shows, X-Files, for example, and Baywatch. You're in an episode of Baywatch. Do you remember that?
Oh, sure. Most of those were just jobs.
Yeah, you know, just gigs.
Murder, She Wrote and all those things. And, you know, you're just, when you first start out, you're just looking for a job. You need to pay your bills. But with each job you get, hopefully you're getting better and more relaxed in your work and... Hopefully, that's the way it is. And you have to wait for a lucky break to get away from the characters like Clerk Number Two or Busboy or Boy with Red Shirt. You know, those are the kind of character descriptions I had. It's like, oh, at some point, I'd really like to have a name.
Yeah.
You know?
And then you got a name in Malcolm in the Middle, of course.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that... You whistled during the episodes to earn royalties. Can that be true?
That is correct, sir. In this litigious society that we live in, I got a call from the music supervisor of Malcolm in the Middle, and he said, "You whistle and you hum in the show, and you should be registered with ASCAP or BMI." It's the music writers, you know, the composers. And I said, why? I said, well, technically it's music whenever you hum or whistle. So you should be the author of that and get paid, as long as it's not an already existing song. And I go, please, all of my compositions are original. I shall not plagiarize. And so I did.
Yeah.
And every time I got a check of a couple $100s, I would throw a party for the crew.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And so that's what it was for. Then the crew kept coming up to me and going, hey, Brian, don't you think Hal might be whistling during this scene? It's like, oh, you want a party? Yeah. Like, it's like, okay.
It's the whistling cottage industry.
That's right. Exactly.
Have you considered releasing an album of your original compositions?
There, right there.
So we owe you $100 now.
$20.
Yeah. Brilliant. And then obviously, I mean, we have to talk about the Breaking Bad. It's still like the peak of peak TV, really.
Yeah.
And the forefront of people's minds. I mean, do you still get Heisenberg on the streets? What's like the most common?
Every day. Yeah. There's not a day I don't go out into public that I'm not recognized.
Really?
Mostly for that, but other things. And that's... you know, it was a side effect, really, of what I love to do. I never really thought about being famous or wanting. I never was the guy in the shower giving my acceptance speech or anything. I wanted to act. I loved the empowerment of acting and how it made me feel. To be able to move someone emotionally by something you say is extraordinarily powerful. Mm. And it made me feel important. And that's what I fell in love with doing. And I was perfectly happy, my wife and I, in a little house, a little baby, and we're going along, and then all of a sudden fame came, and it was like, oh, and I'm still, to this day, still trying to figure out how to reconcile with that, and I usually will wear a hat and glasses out in the public, because I don't want to necessarily welcome any more attention.
Sure.
I have more attention than I ever thought I would or deserve. And that's fine. But I'd like to just kind of live as normal a life as possible, if that's possible, and walk amongst people and talk to people who don't know me. I like that.
Yeah,
I do. I really, I am overjoyed when I'm talking to someone who doesn't know who I am.
What's the strangest sort of fan encounter you've ever had?
There was, you know, there's been some art that was created by Breaking Bad and the influence of Breaking Bad. And I think the tattoos and the body art, you know, I've had people come up to me and go, check this, and they'll pull down their pants and well, maybe not their pants, but their trousers, and show me a tattoo on their thigh or their calf. And then there was one guy who sent me a picture, and I didn't know what it was, and I realized, I stood back and I go, oh, he put it on his bum. He put a big picture of me on his bum. So I don't know if that's flattering or insulting.
I mean, who's going to see that? That's what's confusing about tattoos.
I don't want to even ask that question. I don't want to know. It's, tattoos are so permanent.
Yeah.
I have one.
Oh, yeah?
It's odd for someone my age to have a tattoo, but I'll show it to you. Here it is. And it's
it's the Breaking Bad logo. The
elemental symbol, BRBA.
Yeah.
But you can see where I put it. I put it on the inside of my ring finger of my right hand.
Yeah.
And when my fingers are tight together, you don't see it at all.
Right.
Well, because I'm an actor. I don't want to. And someone said, why would you put it there? Why don't you put it on your wrist or something so people can see it? I go, no, it's for me.
Yeah.
It's when I catch a glimpse of it and I look down and I go, that show changed my life professionally. And it makes me smile.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really nice. That's probably more appropriate than your ass as well, I would have thought.
Yes. I wouldn't want to put that on. My wife would have to look at that, and that's not a good thing.
We've got so much to talk about. What can you tell us about Electric Dreams? This is a new anthology series.
Anthology series based on the short stories of Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
And Electric Dreams is really a beautifully eclectic cross-section of stories that all have relevance in today's life, but they're steeped in the world of the future. And every episode is different, written by someone else, directed by someone else, acted by someone. So you never know what you're going to get. It's a real potpourri.
Yeah.
And very proud of it. It's going to premiere on Channel 4 here in the UK in September. And I'm in one of the episodes as well. It's a fantastic series. I'm also coming back around that time to start rehearsal of a play that I'm doing at the National
Network.
Network, yeah. Based on the Paddy Chayefsky screenplay network back in the 70s.
Yeah, that's very exciting. I mean, this is your first time on a London stage, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
And, you know, Network is, I mean, it's maybe the greatest satire ever written. So
interesting, though, I don't think it's a satire anymore. Okay.
Oh, it's surpassed. It's been surpassed by real life.
By real life. Yeah. Look where we are in what is entertainment? What is news? What is fake news? What is real? Is it necessary to tell the truth? Or if you say something that's not the truth enough, does it become the truth?
Yeah.
And we're living now in very anxiety-ridden times, and there's a lot of cynicism and doubt and distrust of our politicians and our political structures, and there's nationalism and this cause, you know, and a real push for some purity and whatever that means, and, you know, and we're an internationally connected world now, both technology and monetarily, and life has changed. The one thing we can all count on for sure is that life will change. You can either embrace it and go with it, or you can fight it.
Yeah.
But you won't fight it for long because it's going to change.
Yeah. That's interesting. So is your production set in the 70s then? Is it sort of looking at satire as a relic of this story?
To be absolutely honest with you, I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
Ivo van Hove is a brilliant director, originally from Brussels, and he is imaginative fellow, and he comes up with some wonderful staging. If you saw the Euphemia Bridge or the Crucible here in the UK, you realize the scope of his work. And I'm not sure where he wants to go with it yet. I'm not even sure who else is going to be in this play with me yet. Okay. So it's wow. kind of on the, it's still fresh and young.
Yeah.
So, but I'm looking forward to it. We open at the National Theatre in November, and we run all the way through to the end of March.
Wow, that's a long run.
Yeah,
yeah.
Long run. I'm looking
excited.
Forward to it.
I read somewhere when you were on Broadway, you took a vow of silence on your day off. Will you be doing that for Network? I mean, there's a lot of shouting.
I'm going to do one now.
Okay.
It makes for terrible radio. I talked to Audra McDonald, beautiful actor, just phenomenal talent, and she was doing the show Porgy and Bess, and I said, I did my play, my 3-hour play, out of New York for 6 weeks, and I can already feel the strain on my system and my throat. And she said, well, my ear, nose, and throat doctor gave me a prescription of silence on Mondays. You're one day off in the States, Mondays. And he said, you're not to laugh, chortle, you're not to giggle, you're not to whisper, you're not to do anything with your voice. You are to shut down completely.
Wow.
And she did. And I did it as a precautionary measure. And it not only saved my vocal box, but it also saved my energy. Mm-hmm. You realize that if you're not talking at all during the day, everything slows down. And I got to a point where I didn't look at my emails. I didn't do any of that. So I didn't waste any energy. That one day was for me. I needed to recharge my batteries and rest and eat well and take a nap and go for a walk and read a book and do things that are just kind of rejuvenating to the soul.
Yeah.
Because the following day, you're back on the boards and, you know, giving it your all.
Yeah, so, I mean, for Howard Beale, you'll have to be mad as hell every day for like 4 or 5 months. I mean, you're going to need that time off.
I'm going to need it. I'm going to need the rest, and I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
And by this stage in my career, I've worked long enough, almost 40 years, that I know when I need to rest and when I can go.
Yeah.
And so I just shut myself down when I know I need to recharge the batteries.
Brian Cranston, thank you so much for your time.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Bye.
And we're back, just in time for this week's reviews. Now, I thought we were going to have an unprecedented situation here on the podcast this week, whereby none of us had seen a single film out this week. We are consummate professionals here at the Empire Podcast. However, I then realised that Valerian actually came out on Wednesday, and we've all seen that. So we can talk about Valerian. So we should probably start with that one, given that we have nothing resembling coherence to say about the others. Valerian, or to give it its full title, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. This is Luc Besson's long gestating adaptation of the French comic Valerian A. Loreline, and stars Dane DeHaan as Valerian and Cara Delevingne as Loreline, a pair of space-based special agents who are sucked into a mystery surrounding the fate of Alpha, a city made up of, yes, indeed, a thousand planets worth of species. It's kind of a latter-day Babylon 5. It's a brightly coloured, batshit mental film. It involves a psychic jellyfish, talking pterodactyls, Rihanna, and a small lizard that shits magic pearls. Now, Nick, you're our resident Besson whisperer. What did you make of it?
It is nutsoid. As you'd expect from the man who brought us Lucy, his last film. Yeah, it's mad. I mean, I did interview Luc Besson for this several times, and this has been the film he has wanted to make his whole career, basically, since he was a small boy. He got hooked on the comic book, the Valerian and Loreline comic books, which were written by Pierre Christin, with illustrations by Jean-Claude Mézières, who ended up working on The Fifth Element with him. He did some of the designs for that. But he has wanted to make that. And this is like the granddaddy or grandma of comic books. It's influenced Star Wars, for one thing. There are Han being frozen in carbonite and wheeled along is an image that's taken from one of the issues of this that I've read.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you look at it and so many sci-fi things have ripped stuff off from this. So it's very, very iconic. It's very strange, it's got to be said. I read a whole bunch of these in preparation for my interviews, and it's absolute madness. So the film is a good representation of that, but then you add Luc Besson's distinctive, eccentric kind of style, what he does with, like, The Fifth Element is obviously a very eccentric film itself. It's a bizarre film, and I kind of have to applaud it for swinging for the fences. And there is stuff in this film that is just utterly demented.
I know.
There's a scene I actually really like where there's some kind of alien king who is being served a banquet, and there's a whole column of these alien like waiters basically bringing him bizarre dishes for him to sample. And he decides he wants to eat Cara Delevingne's brain. But it's just a bizarre, insane, screwball comedy kind of scene that you wouldn't see in any other kind of film, you know.
Nor should you, really.
Didn't like this, did
no,
you?
I thought it was rubbish. I know, I really like Luc Besson. I mean, Leon is one of my all-time favourite films. It's in my top five. I love The Fifth Element. I love loads of his stuff. This, though, it just felt like a mess. Like The Fifth Element is incredibly stylized, very visual, very vibrant. It's an amazing sort of vision of this kind of crazy offbeat future, but it makes coherent sense, even if sections of it are written in a gibberish language. This, though, just meandered all over the place. And like that sequence where you do, at the beginning, see that lizard sort of like defecating pearls, all, and you're like, what the fuck is going on?
There is an alien that shits pearls. That's hard to deny. That's a tough one to shy away from. Yeah, I mean, it's got, I don't know how many species of aliens, but there's a lot stuffed in here.
There's a lot of invention.
So it's set on Alpha, which is this space station. There's a long backstory to it.
Best hope for peace.
Yeah, which is basically a space station where every alien in the galaxy, alien species just turn up and start living on this place, and it's gigantic. And there are all these different, there's like a water land where you get all the water aliens and gas lands where you get like aliens that are made of
like
gas.
It's a shit crystal maze.
It's a bit like the crystal maze. Yeah, that's true. And so the film kind of takes you on a journey. I do think he has put too much in this film. It's almost 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I do think it's exhausting. So hectic. There's so much going on. And another thing we have to touch on, unlike The Fifth Element, which had Bruce Willis and Gary Oldman as bringing the star power, I don't think Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne bring that kind of presence.
I agree. Weirdly, I had no problem with Cara Delevingne. I thought she was fine. And she, let's be honest, it's called Valeria, but she's the main character. She has more screen time than he does. Well, stop casting Dane DeHaan, I guess is what I want to say. And I don't mean stop casting him full stop. I just mean he's not a leading man. Like, he's a character actor and a really good character actor, but he seems to be falling into leading roles of late, and I think that's not good.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of Dane DeHaan, the leading man. I think he's much better in a supporting capacity. But he doesn't have the charisma to carry this character at all.
It's a specific kind of character. He's a kind of he's an intergalactic space agent. He's a guy who's full of derring-do and bright and bushy-tailed, and Dane DeHaan is not that. Like, I think he's very good in certain roles. I don't think he fits this one particularly well. And it does. And the film is very kind of screwball comedy-esque, the way it's written.
Yeah.
And I don't think it quite gels with the kind of lead pair. I do like things about this film. I really like there's an action sequence which is set in a marketplace which has parallel dimensions, so they're flicking between different dimensions, and that's never been done on screen before.
Yeah, and there's a bit where he's part in one dimension and his arm's in the other one.
Yeah, and so there's so much invention, and I think you can sense Luc Besson's just enthusiasm for this project. Like, you can tell he's having a great time. He's trying to get as much as he can in from all these different comic books he loves. But I think it's ultimately exhausting to watch. And that's a kind of a big problem. And it's very uneven as well.
And what did we give this?
2 stars.
We gave this 2 stars. So, you know, watch it if you like. Also out this week is The Emoji Movie. The story of which is, I mean, does anyone actually care? This is about an emoji from what I can gather, kind of tits about doing product placement for various apps and making people beg for the sweet release of death. We sent Helen down to review this, and if I'm honest, I don't think she's really forgiven us. She gave this film 1 star and 3 steaming poo emojis, each of which were voiced by Sir Patrick Stewart.
Crumbs, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but I do know that she's actually had to leave the country.
Yeah.
As a result.
Yeah.
And
that's why she's not here today. She has fled.
That's right. And from her mountain Erie, where she's recuperating, she sent the following Crazy.
Okay.
Stroke, cry for help. Yeah. She does actually say she's too late for help, so don't worry there. But she says fundamentally, it doesn't seem to understand what either emojis or movies are meant to do, which is to convey emotional human connection. The plot, TJ Miller plays a meh emoji who just feels too strongly about everything, switches back and forth between eye-rolling at phone use and toadying up to product placing app makers. It needs to be witty to work even vaguely, and instead we get James Corden shouting a lot. Kids seem into the characters at the start, but they're all switched off by the end. This is, I presume she saw it at one of those family screenings.
Fun in the foyer type rather family than, yeah, things, yeah.
And she ends with, just save yourselves, it's too late for me.
Well,
so that's a recommendation.
That's a recommendation.
Yeah, we do say one star is a recommendation.
Yes, yes, it
if
is.
If you're in prison or on a very, very, very long intergalactic space flight.
Yeah. So don't watch that. Also out this week, Gareth Tunley's horror The Ghoul is out this week. It stars Alice Lowe and Tom Meaton. Meaton is a cop investigating a double murder, and Lowe is a profiler who helps him go undercover as a mental patient. Our very own horror guru Kim Newman saw this one, and he said, and I quote, "It's a powerful, disturbing and intense. It is powerful, disturbing and intense viewing. This isn't going to be everyone's cup of tea." And yet he gave it 4 stars. Make of that what you will. I think that's a recommendation. He does think it's good in Kim's own inimitable way.
Simon Crook, who's also one of our horror icons.
Yeah.
In the Empire Stable, says that the Gould is really Gould.
That's the most Simon Crook thing.
Via Twitter.
Crookie says Gould, Kim says...
And he said it was made for the price of a Scotch egg, and it's a Brit indie miracle.
Well, go and see the Gould.
It depends where you get
a
Scotch egg from, because you can get them from the Harrods Food Hall, and they probably cost... You could probably get a couple of minutes.
Or you can get Bernard Matthews ones, which are less
so. You can get Scotch duck eggs that are quite expensive.
Yeah, a Scotch quail egg.
This is the thing. Good God.
So, yeah, we should, yeah.
Okay, Ghoul,
shame
Ghoul,
that none
4 stars.
Of us have seen
none of, well, none of us have seen anything. We've pretty much established this.
And, no, Anne Wright and Maudie as well, also getting great reviews.
Yeah, we haven't gotten to that yet. First of all, we're going to talk about Williams, directed by Morgan Matthews, which is about the ups and downs of the British Formula One team of the same name, which centres around Sir Frank Williams, who's been quadriplegic since a road accident in 1986. Dan Jolin gave this 3 stars and called it, wait for it, an affectionate but unflinching portrait of a family consumed by its dedication to Formula One.
Smell it with your eyes.
Smell it with your eyes, says Dan Jolin. Yes, so there, good. And yes,
we have made this point before, but you can make anyone's review sound stupid.
If you say in the Top Gear voice.
This is a thing that happens in the office quite regularly. James or Chris will walk around, see what you're writing, and read it in that voice and ruin it. Ruin everything. Shatter your dreams.
Yeah. Yeah. To be fair, it's more Chris than anyone else.
Chris does that an awful lot.
Yeah. It's
doesn't like it when you do it with his work, though.
No, he doesn't. No,
although
he
it's pretty funny.
But yes, Maudie is out this week. This is Aisling Walsh's film, which stars Ethan Hawke and Sally Hawkins.
Interesting. See what Ethan, I did there? Ethan Hawke is also in Valerian as a space pimp.
Yes, he is.
Called Joe.
Yes, he is.
Joe the space pimp.
Joe the space
pimp. If it had Jeremy Renner in it, it would be Hawkins, Hawkeye.
What is going on? The space pimp stars in a true life tale of arthritic artist Maudie Dowley, who lives with her disapproving aunt in Nova Scotia in the 1930s.
Space pimp. What did you say?
Space pimp. Ethan Hawke, we've just established he's a space pimp.
Sorry. Yeah.
He's in Maudie, therefore, you see what I did there.
Yeah, vaguely.
We have this 4 stars. Do you have anything to add on Maudie, Phil?
No, but I've heard it's really good.
It's good.
I wish I'd seen it.
Yes.
Next week, I'm going to have seen everything.
Well, funnily, that brings us on to the last one, which I must say I think is an inexplicable one. So it's set in Denmark in the aftermath of World War II.
Yeah.
It involves a surplus of landmines.
Yeah.
It's in Danish, and yet you haven't seen it. What the fuck is up with that?
It's a good question.
It is, in fact, called Land of Mine.
Land of Mine.
Which is
That's
possessive and a pun.
Yeah.
That's strong. I like that word.
Okay.
It is strong.
Is there a scene where somebody says, what happens if you step on one, and someone else goes, well, traditional practice is to leap up 50 yards in the air and scatter yourself liberally across the surrounding countryside.
They do.
Anna Blackadder. Yes. I haven't seen it. I would have seen it. I have a very small child who has landmines of her own. I think this film is Oscar nominated. In the best foreign film category, I think I'm right in saying that.
Well, I mean,
and it's apparently absolutely gripping.
It was released in 2015, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
it's been out in Europe for like over a year.
Has.
So,
my understanding is that the story of German POWs forced to clear up. I think they planted 2 million landmines on the Danish coast after the war. It's a true story, and about this horrifying prospect seen through the eyes of young Germans. And it's apparently gripping. I have not seen it, but we. given
it? We gave it three of our most Danish stars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Three stars.
And that is it for the most shambolic podcast in quite some time. We'll be back next week with your regular host, you'll be pleased to know. And there's every possibility we'll be talking to David Lowry, the director of A Ghost Story. Alternatively, we might just stand in a corner with a sheet over our heads and stare at him for 15 minutes. We shall see. Until that time, it is so long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen and goodbye from our intrepid team of Nick.
Goodbye.
And Phil.
Goodbye.
And myself. Until next time.